There's the members here that could do a better job than myself, but I'll do the best I can. Are you ready to talk now?
Yeah, I'll... I'm Irving Reed. I came to Alaska in 1900, May 1900. I live on Farmers Loop Road. What was this? My father was a lawyer and a judge. My mother, Ida McKinney, was housewife. anything more that's on that agenda that we were going to get out? Does that cover the whole thing?
Oh, I think that'd do, Irving. You might mention, excuse me, about your family, your sons.
I have two daughters and a son.
And your wife?
They're all outside, though.
Where were you born?
Oh, I was born in Seattle. And I have I have 13 grandchildren, if that is an interest. This whole thing of getting the buffalo into Alaska started at White Horse Smith's Roadhouse in Fox way back in the winter of 1924 and 25. I was surveying the Iffy Company's claims for patent that year. I had the contract to do all their work. And in this March 1925, Sam White came through Fox on his way across Alaska. He was setting up these triangulation stations for the Coast and Geodetic Survey. He got a telling me about the deer in Maine. He came from the northern part of Maine, and he said the snow got 5 feet deep every winter there, and it got 50 below every winter, and he thought they ought to have deer in here. Well, I was pretty much game-minded, and I thought so, too. I thought it'd be a fine thing if we could have deer here. Coming from Nome, I didn't feel like ever killing a caribou, just like a man from the cattle states in the Middle West asking to go out and kill a cow, because they were reindeer all around. They were just like cows to us. They weren't wild animals at all. So we talked to that every evening, and he thought this would be a small animal that would be larger than a rabbit and smaller than a caribou, and we would have a nice piece of meat and wouldn't have to bother about such a big animal as a caribou or a moose. So when I got into town that next fall, Jack Warwick and Frank Dufresne had come from Nome. I knew them both in Nome. They'd come up the Kobuk with a team of pure white Siberians. And they introduced me to Larry Palmer, who was the head then of the Biological Survey in Fairbanks. And we had several talks on this thing in the biological headquarters that was on the corner of Cushman and 8th, where there was afterwards a rooming house in this house, but this was they had the headquarters, the Biological Survey, there at the time. And we brought several other people into the discussion. I think Sam White and George King, who's over here at Boundary now. Doc Quitney, a dentist, was the game commissioner for the 4th Division. The Alaska Game Commission had just been started in 1924, and about a year old then. So my idea was to go around to the different ardent sportsmen in Fairbanks and collect $20 apiece and get the deer in here and just start them going. But Frank Dufresne thought we ought to get government, either federal or territorial, help to get them in. So the thing dragged along. In the spring of... We decided we would call a meeting of all the sportsmen and see what they wanted to do. In the spring of 1926, a meeting of the Fairbanks sportsmen are called at the Biological Survey's headquarters and Palmer's residence is 8th and Cushman. The Tanna Yukon Game Protective and Propagation Association was formed at this meeting. This was the forerunner and father of the Tanana Valley Sportsmen Association. I was elected president and George King was elected secretary. I don't remember who the other officers were, but I think Lou Joy was vice president. It was decided at the meeting to ask the territorial legislature for money for the introduction of white-tailed deer. Someone suggested that other game animals be put on the list also, in case we didn't get any deer. Someone, I don't know who, suggested elk. Donald McDonald, the father of the Alaska Highway, suggested buffalo. So the meeting adopted a motion to ask the legislature for money for the introduction of white-tailed deer, elk, and buffalo. We considered the buffalo the least desirable of the animals for introduction and just added them to the list of Blease McDonald. In the fall of 1926, Fred Johnston, one of the enthusiastic sportsmen at the meeting, was elected to the territorial legislature for the 1927 session. He got deer, elk, and bison on a territorial stocking program and secured appropriation of $12,000 for the program. The Alaska Game Commission was to secure the animals and to disperse the money for the introduction of all or any one of these animals into interior Alaska. In the summer of 1927, Doc Whitney resigned as Alaska Game Commissioner, and I was appointed in his place. At the Alaska Game Commission meeting in November 1927, Hugh Terhune, executive officer of the AGC, told us that bison would be the only animals available for introduction on the following spring. To comply with the provisions of the stocking program, an introduction of some one animal had to be made in the spring of 1928, so we had to take the buffalo to keep the program going. In April of 1928, I received a telegram from the superintendent of the National Bison Range requesting me to send a man to Moise, Montana, to receive the animals and to transport them to Fairbanks. I think Terhune at the time, in the meantime, had arranged for this because he was in touch with, he was a member of the Biological Survey and was in touch with all these people. After consulting with the members of the Biological Survey and Association, that's the Game Protective Association, we chose Dick Perkins, an Alaskan pioneer, an old-time cattleman, whose father had been the biggest cattle rancher in the state of Oregon. Dick left immediately for Moise and superintended the selection and crating of the buffalo. On May 12, 1928, I received a telegram stating that 23 animals had been chosen, 2 to 4 years of age and averaging about 1,000 pounds a head. The choice consisted of 17 cows and 6 bulls. The Northern Pacific Railroad gave us special services to Seattle, where the animals were loaded on the steamer Northwestern of the Alaska Steamship Company. They arrived in Seward on May 27 and were loaded on the Alaska Railroad freight cars and arrived in Fairbanks on Wednesday evening of June 2, 1928.
5 days to come from here, from Seward here, just about as long as it took them to get to Seattle to Seward on a boat. When word was received of the arrival of the buffalo at Seward, the association appointed a transportation committee consisting of Guy Jennings, who was the agent here of the railroad, Jim Jorgensen, and another man whose name I have forgotten, and a corral or unloading committee composed of E.B. Collins, Bob Kelly, and another man whose name I have also forgotten. The transportation committee secured trucks from the Alaska Agricultural College and School of Mines, the Fairbanks Exploration Company, and 5 Fairbanks Express companies, of which only the Sourdough Express is now in existence. Gasoline and oil and the expenses and services of the drivers were paid for by the Alaska Game Commission out of the territorial appropriation. The corral committee left immediately for the Big Delaware River, where they hired a crew, picked out a site, and constructed a large pole corral. Due to the experience and conscientious care of Dick Perkins,
The animals arrived in Fairbanks in wonderful condition. The night after the animals arrived, a watchman was hired to keep the crowd from exciting the animals and the small boys of town from climbing into the crates. The next morning, we requisitioned the big derrick of the Alaska Railroad and began the ticklish job of lifting the crates off the flat cars and transferring them to the trucks. The noise and unusual activity excited the big four-year-old bull of the herd, and he began to fight his crate. There was a breaking and cracking of boards, and it looked for a moment as though he would be out among the Fairbanks townsfolk. Cables were hastily wound around his crate in all directions, and he was picked up as soon as possible and put on a truck, where the springs made his footing so uncertain he was unable to butt. Palmer wanted a bull and two cows for observation and to hold over winter until the next spring in case the other buffalo didn't make a go of it. These animals were to be placed at the biological experiment station just east of the buildings of the Alaska Agricultural College and School of Mines. So his three hired student helpers picked out three animals and transported them by truck to the college. When he went out to look at them that afternoon, he found that these bright boys, to everybody's amusement, had picked out three cows, no bull. As the big herd bull appeared to be badly scarred and rubbed by his fighting of the crate, he gave him to Palmer to keep over winter. As soon as each truck was loaded, it was started over the Richardson Highway on its 93-mile trip to Big Delta. The last truck was followed by an expert automobile man who volunteered his services in case of a breakdown. However, the only accident was a temporary bogging down of one truck where the narrow gravel road was undergoing repair. As a truck arrived at the Tanana River, they were ferried across to the little settlement of McCarty, or Big Delta. From McCarty, it was only a matter of 5 miles to the corral near the Big Delta River. Every resident of Fairbanks who had a car or could bum a ride was at the corral. Rieger Wallen did a thriving business at a roadhouse, selling meals and renting rooms. We backed each truck to a ramp on slightly sloping ground, knocked the backs out of the crates, and pulled the buffalo out one by one by their tails. One cow had her hip knocked down or dislocated. Of all the bison unloaded, she was the only one that was in any way mean, and with a leaping charge, she chased Dick Perkins up a tree and Frank Dufresne behind another one, much to everybody's amusement. After several days, we decided to shoot her as she would never recover from her injuries caused by the rough sea trip from Seattle to Seward. The following spring, the college dug a sewer line across the bison enclosure. One of Palmer's cows rolled in the freshly excavated dirt and got her hump wedged down in the ditch. She died of a broken blood vessel, struggling to get out before she could be rescued. Another cow, that same winter of 1928-29, broke through the ice on the Big Delta River and drowned. So our entire interior Alaska Fairbanks herd is descended from Treaty Head since Palmer in the summer of 1929 trucked his two cows and the big bull to Big Delta. It was two or three years before they would condescend to join the rest of the herd. When the animals were first taken out of the crates, they were held in the corral for two or three days so as to restore the circulation in their limbs and to allow them to get their strength back. They were fed hay donated by the Fairbanks stores. Salt blocks were placed that summer near the corral and also in the summer of 1929 by the association so as to get the animals used to staying around the Big Delta area. The herd took care of itself after being turned loose. It reached a peak of about 500 head in the late 1930s and is now down to probably around 200 animals. In 1952, a planting was made by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service a short distance above Slana in the Copper River Valley. These animals were not placed in a corral, but were brought over one by one and took two or three years to get together, one cow and calf being seen as far west as Eureka on the Anchorage Highway. This small bunch had increased to about 50 by 1960. Subsequent plannings were made by the State Department of Fish and Game and the Copper River Watershed. Due to the foresight of the 1963 legislature, five ranchers, I forget the exact number, I think it was five, have secured about six young buffalo apiece to raise. I have great hope that the buffalo we brought in with such reluctance in 1928 will really be the cattle which can be raised in Alaska without winter shelter and may become the start of an Alaskan cattle industry. The bringing of buffalo to Alaska is really a reintroduction of these animals. 5,000 years ago, the natives were hunting buffalo, elk, and muskoxen near the mouth of the Firth River on the Arctic coast of northwest Canada. Buffalo horns of the wood bison type have been picked up near Point Barrow. The anthropologists tell me the Indians were hunting buffalo in the upper Tanana Valley only 150 to 200 years ago. So this is no exotic introduction. I believe that is right, isn't it, Ivor? That's what I'm... Oh, I'm... That's kind of a brief thing. I would like to answer any questions.
We enjoyed your story, Irving. Has anyone any questions that they'd like to ask Mr. Reed?
Do you really think, Irving, that the farmers, the ranchers, will be able to raise these? I came from Montana, where they tried somewhat similar experiments, and they weren't very successful.
Well, I had a fellow working for me that had charge of a ranch in Montana, and he had cattle and buffalo and elk, and he was raising buffalo right along with his cattle. He didn't own the ranch, but he was running it. And I believe in Dakota, on the bison range there, the Wichita range, I think it is, they are raising, that's in the last... By the way, in the last geographic, they're raising buffalo there and slaughtering them. It's just a question of how you handle them. They're just as tame as cattle. There's no apparently they act very much like cattle.
Several ranches in Canada where they're getting overpopulated and they're trying to do something about it.
Their meat is very good. Now this fellow Burl Mercer, he got five or six head of these young, but his father raises them in Nebraska, and he started to bring a herd up here, and the Fish and Wildlife, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, he had the cars all backed up on the siding and ready to go, and the Fish and Wildlife Service stopped him, said there were wild animals in Alaska and he couldn't bring them up here. So he brought up these Scotch Highland cattle instead. And he was been regretting, he's telling me, he regretted ever since he never got any buffalo.
Well, perhaps it's because where the wire was introduced there, he seemed to have quite a problem with skinning.
Yeah. Well, he's got 10 or 20,000 acres down there that he can run them on. I saw the five of the ones down here. There's two people on the Clear Creek Road. The people that have a lodge at Clear Creek got six, and there's another fellow right where the road starts out going down to Clear Creek. They have six. And they were just as tame as could be, as cute as could be. They were young fellows. They reminded me of these old cartoons of Alphonse and Gaston, with the whiskers sticking out this and a little beard this way.
I know they're doing quite well up in the
I wondered how they were doing up there. They introduced them right, I think, up there. But the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in 1952, they didn't do a good job at all. They put them out one by one. It took them a long time to get together, and they never did increase. Pardon?
They put 35 last year into a couple of them, and they had 10 young this year.
Yeah. Well, that.
So
they're really going to go there too. I was hoping they'd distribute them around and we could have buffalo hunting all over Alaska, for that matter. But I really think, though, the ultimate what's going to ultimately become of them. They're going to be a domesticated animal. Well, they're going to be our cattle up here, because they, Burl Mercer tells me that he's got a stream that runs 34 degrees all year round through his place. And these Scotch Highland cattle died of thirst with the water right in front of them. They wouldn't drink that cold water in the wintertime. And they, two or three of them died of thirst before he knew what was the matter, and then he had to heat the water for them before they keep them going. Well, you don't have to heat any water for buffalo, that's a cinch.
What happened to the idea for the deer? How often water
was that brought down? Well, that's, there is a biologist here. I won't say his name. I respect him. I liked him very much. He isn't with us anymore. And I respect him a lot. But he didn't get wind of this before it was too late to get the buffalo. But he successfully blocked us getting the elk in here. And I stayed on the Alaskan Game Commission 13 years trying to break that thing through, and I never could, and finally got disgusted and resigned. He said we had enough fine game animals and they would crowd out the caribou. Well, I told him, I wrote him back, and I said, if I live 20 years and this thing is a mistake, I'll go out with a box of cartridges and correct it. But he never answered that letter. But I think elk would have been fine. Well, we got in such a row about the elk that we never did get around to getting the deer, but he would have bucked that too, I'm sure.
Was there any feasibility study made about whether or not the white-tailed deer and the elk could live during the winter and find enough to keep them going? I've often wondered, if I've gone down the path summit on the Alaska Road, down through the valley, it's quite reminiscent of Montana, Washington.
They killed two mule deer. What's that river that Mayo's is on? Not the Stewart, but the... You know where the Mayo, the silver mines are on?
Stewart.
Stewart, is it? Well, right at the mouth of Stewart River, they killed two mule deer right there that have come up along the road, that followed the road on up. As the clearing of the forests have opened up grasslands, they have worked their way up to the headwaters of the Yukon River. Now, there isn't any reason why they won't go here, because that's cooler country than this is, and just as tough to get along in. But I think quite... Pardon?
There were several attachments.
Yeah. Well, I think those main whitetail there would go here, too. They're a little smaller, but I think they'd go.
Well, they have them on Labrador.
Pardon?
You have them on Labrador, which is a lot tougher than
here. Yeah, a lot tougher
than
here.
Where did the muskox?
Well, I've got a deal on the muskox, too. If I've got time enough and I'm not boring you people too much, I'll...
You have.
So I'll get out about what we did about the muskox. And I was sure frustrated on the muskox.
Surely something can still be done. I hear the herd is getting very large and in the back out.
Well, the same deal on the muskox is with the buffalo. Now, I hope we can get together with Burl Mercer and get some muskoxen up here and start this thing going. I first heard about this muskoxen. My father was up here, and he discovered a sulfur mine up on Mount McCushion on Unalaska Island, and he went back to the east to float a company to get it out. That's the time that all our sulfur came from Sicily, and before they discovered the Louisiana sulfur mines. So I was left in my grandfather's to take care of my grandparents to take care of me, and I was just able to read these books, and my grandfather was an adventurer, and he had all these old books, and I read all about Cain and the fellows that were early explorers in the north, and that's the first time I ever heard about muskoxen. In 1906, I was a blacksmith's helper at 10 and a half above on Ophir Creek on Seward Peninsula, and was one of the men there that in the bunkhouse was a had been a hunter for the whalers at Herschel Island, and he said he'd killed this animal, little animal out, and he didn't know what it was at first, and then he was told when he brought it in that it was a muskox. And he said at that time, I had supposed as a kid they had muskox all over the Arctic, but he said the time there wasn't any at that time east of the, or west of the Mackenzie River. They were all east of the Mackenzie River. So, and he also, that this got, they, you know, these old miners, there were very, lots of very intelligent people that were really well educated, and they got a, quite a discussion going. And one of these fellows told me that the, he had known there was a herd up here on the Chandelier Lake, and two French Canadians had gone in there in 1897 and killed a whole bunch, ended it. And I believe that to be true, because Henry Appel told me that when he was in 95, when he was going up the Yukon with a passenger on a sled, at the mouth of the Nation River, an Indian told him he'd killed a bear with horns. And he went up there. He'd been up in the muskox country, knew what they were. And he'd been up, went up to look at this hide that the Indian had, and it was a muskox hide. So there must have been a muskox in Alaska at that time.
Well, Father Geist found a lot of heads.
Well,
north and east of Point Hope.
That's right. Yeah. During last year at the University of California, I was still interested in muskox, and I read a lot about it, and I read Macmillan's account and Perry's account of hunting them and their descriptions, and I also talked to Stephenson. I knew him in Nome in 1913. In 1919, I traveled to Nome on a steamer Victoria with Charlie Bauer, and he told me that he knew the man, the Eskimo, that was the 12 years old when the last muskoxen was killed south of Barrow at what he called it Omingmiup Creek in 1865. So that was the last herd that those people were able to kill. And they got guns, you know, and the muskox hadn't a chance with the with a man with a gun. In 1921, I was in New York and saw their collection of muskox at the Bronx Zoo, and I went in and introduced myself to Dr. Hornaday, who was a very famous naturalist, and I talked to him about their domestication and how they did at the zoo. And I also read Stephenson's book when it came out, The Friendly Arctic, and he had a lot about muskoxen. I guess you've read that, Jim. In the late 1920s, the Eskimo reindeer herds had reached about 500,000 in numbers, but they hadn't any market for their meat. And President Charles Bunnell was advocating native settlements along the hills, which have been all taken up since, back of college, and thought possibly muskoxen would be better for them than reindeer if we could domesticate them. And I had a man working for me named Bill Albee, who came, he was quite a writer afterwards, but he was made the most wonderful hand looms you ever saw, and his wife was a great weaver. And he was very anxious to teach these natives how to weave cloth. And that would have been really their salvation. That would have been a wonderful industry, hand-woven stuff. You know, in Norway, they make, all those villages make a lot of money doing that. But he didn't have a college education, so he couldn't get the appointment with the Bureau of Indian Affairs. In 1922, I was Alaska Game Commissioner for the 4th Division when 28 for the 4th Division when the U.S. Representative, later Senator C.C. Dickinson, led a Congressional Agricultural Committee of Congress to Alaska to look in Alaskan economy and agriculture.
I had a conference with Dickinson and his party, President Charles Bunnell, and Hugh Terhune, executive officer of the Alaska Game Commission, in the college library on Muskoxen. Dickinson was favorably impressed and asked me to write him a letter on the muskox question. That was in 1928. I wrote him a letter on October 28, 1929, and I have the original draft and copies of that letter. A bill was introduced in Congress by Senator Norbeck, who was the senior senator from Iowa, and then Dickinson was a junior, for the introduction of muskoxen into Alaska, carrying an appropriation of $40,000. The bill was signed by President Hoover on May 27, 1930. Josh, J-O-H-S, period. I don't know what that stands for. What does that stand for, Ivor?
Joshua.
Huh? Joshua?
I don't know.
It's a Norwegian Lund of Ålesund, Norway, contract to secure the muskoxen from Greenland. On November 4, 1934, 34 muskoxen arrived in crates in Fairbanks via the Alaska Railroad. These consisted of 17 calves born that year, 16 yearlings, and 1 2-year-old cow. There were 13 males and 19 females. In 1934, 9 calves were born between April 22 and May 4th. In 1935, 13 calves were born between April 20th and May 27th. In 1936, all cows aborted because of improper feeding. In 1931, there were 3 deaths. One cow died from injuries received on slipping on ice. One bull died of lumpy jaw. One cow died of a twisted neck. In 1932, there were 3 deaths, 2 immature bulls and 1 immature cow being killed by bears. In 1933, there were 3 deaths, 1 bull and 2 cows being killed by bears. In 1934, there were 5 deaths, 1 calf being stillborn, 2 bulls killed by fighting, and 1 cow died from, I don't know what you'd call it, calf birth, I guess. You say a woman dies of childbirth. 1 calf died of natural causes. In 1935, there were 11 deaths, 1 cow dying of a twisted neck in transit to Nunavak Island, 1 cow died at calf birth, 2 calves were stillborn, 5 calves killed by overcrowding and goring. In 1935, 3 cows and 2 bulls were shipped to Nunavak Island. In 1936, the remaining 27 oxen were shipped to Nunavak Island. Total deaths, 25. Total births, 22. Excess of deaths over births, 3. 31 animals were released on Nunavak Island. And that's the history of the introduction. There's a lot more to this than that, though. You people are interested in it. I have a lot of pictures. These animals produce every year from 6 to 8 pounds of wool. The wool, according to my friend Teal of Vermont, who went back to northern Canada to get some muskoxen, is worth $40 a pound. So each muskox will produce, if you say 7 pounds of wool, $280 worth of wool a year. And that's about as good a cattle animal or sheep animal as you could get. They are not oxen. John Teal says from his blood tests and other things that they're more really related to the goats. Their bawl or bellow is something between a sheep's blatant and a cow's moo, if you can imagine such a thing. But they, according to Teal, are an aberrant goat. No, they don't look anywhere as near like a goat. They look like more like bison. They are very
There's a, and I'll go back. In 1919, the Canadian government appointed a commission to look into the domestication of caribou and the bringing in of reindeer and the domestication of muskoxen. And they're described in that report as of a gentle and quiet disposition. And Teal has found them to be very, very tame. He says they are the most intelligent of all the herbivore animals. And they would go down to they'd go down, they had a lake on his place, and they'd go down swimming, and the muskox would come along going swimming with them. So, and I was there on his ranch in Vermont, and I went right in among them. He had the biggest muskoxen that was ever in the world in these later times. It weighed 1,200 pounds. And the ordinary muskox in Canada, the ordinary bull weighs about 900, I should imagine, and the cows weigh about 700. But this was a really a monstrous animal. He'd grown so fast that his feet were sore. I believe they call that thrush. I don't know anything about this, but he said they had to have, he was going to have his feet operated on. But in the breeding season, he said he was a little bit he got untrustworthy. But that's the same thing that happens to a bull or anything else. I have here a. I have here all kinds of pictures there when they first came in. And here's Dickinson's letter. And here's what Teal said about, this is in June 25, 1958. On Sunday evening we had the first calf born here, a fine little bull. 3 minutes after birth he was on his feet and driving for the milk bag. The cow is remarkably tame and allows me not only to milk her, but to pick up the calf and walk around with it. At the same time, she is worriedly attentive and does not appreciate the other muskoxen near. I know what the reason of that is. Evidently, when they crowd them, the older animals will hook or gore the calves if they bother them, and that's what happened in college when they lost five calves. They crowded them all in and feeding them, and the older animals hooked them. I have a lot of this stuff from Teal, and you might be interested in it. But the extraordinary thing is the attitude taken by the Fish and Wildlife Service in Washington, D.C. Men that had never seen a muskoxen told how untamable and terribly wild and vicious they were when Teal was coming out with these articles showing how tame they were. And there was a man here that worked with Palmer who had been badly mauled by and gored by the domestic bull at the university and the experiment station. And he worked for Palmer afterwards, but he was scared to death of these any animal with horns on. And when I was trying to get this experiment started again, and they came up in the Senate, and they asked him, he said he knew more about muskox than anybody in the world, and they were vicious animals and couldn't be tamed. So they took his word, and they never did anything more about the experiment. These are the muskoxen on Nunavak Island, taken from the air. These are pictures. You can see what made that fellow scared of the.
Well, Irving, these muskoxen over there in Nunavak Island, how are they thriving at the present time?
They increased to about 150 head. They were put out there in 35 and 36.
These pundits in Washington said they only bred every other year, but then they were surprised when they bred every year and had a calf. So they increased to 150 head. And then there was a school teacher over there that during the war, he was afterwards, they got him on malfeasance or something in office. And he told the Eskimos to go out and kill him. And they had 25,000 reindeer on the island, all kinds of seafood, but they preferred the muskox meat to anything else, and skins were turning up in Nome. And a party went out there from here through over the island, and they only could count 14 head. So they had an Eskimos reduced them down to 14 head. And so I went, Krug was in here at the time, and I went and made a presentation to Krug and wrote a long letter on it, and he sent some men out there and they stopped that. So they're down back now to about 200 or 300 head, and I think we should get some of them to start this thing again.
Mr. King, who's the manager, was in the other day, he said we're 450.
450 now, huh? Well, that's wonderful. I think we were really...
About time we got some on our Arctic slope.
Yes, I think, though, the domestication of them is... it would be a shame to put them out as a game animal, an animal that would give you $280 at least of wool a year.
Are they selling any of this wool?
Teal won't sell any. He's got a lot of it, but he won't sell any. He says he wanted it for experimental purposes. Stephenson had a suit made of it, and he said it wore, took dye fine, and it wore like iron. The wool has been submitted to the people and experts in the East, and they said it was the finest wool in the world. There's nothing compares with it. And I have a scarf. You can just take the scarf and fold it up in your hand like this. And they made socks out of it up here, and they were almost too warm to wear right in the middle of winter.
What are they collecting this wool
at Runivac? No, there's nothing done. Just running, just lying on the ground, going to waste. It's you can't shear the animals. They sheared one, sheared a cow in the Bronx Zoo, and they cut the guard hairs off and sheared her because it was summertime, and she died of pneumonia. So they'd have to collect the wool. It comes off in a blanket in the spring, and then collect that.
They're easy to pluck, you know.
Pardon?
They're easy to pluck.
Yes, easy to pluck. Yeah.
We draw them through the brush here.
Uh-huh.
I think 7 or 8 pounds.
Yeah, they said 6 to 8 pounds is what Teal told me. Yeah.
Similar to mangor rabbits.
Yeah. Well, I believe they do certain kinds in the Near East. They do certain kinds of goats too. They pluck the wool from them. That they don't ever shear them.
Well, does anyone here know if it's brush or not? But Nunavak, if you could go there and collect some of this wool. No, it's in Nunavak. It's not brush. So they grow some, eh? And the mice collect all the wool and use it for nests.
Who is Teal? Somebody, who is Teal? Who is speaking?
John Teal. There's a long story on that. He came here, he was anxious to get started in this town, and he was going to bring his musk oxen here. He had 5 head at that time. And I wanted to raise money in this town to bring him here. But he said, no, Patty is going to get a Rockefeller grant to bring him here. It'll take about, he said, $5,000, but we wanted to get a grant of $10,000 because I'm sure that $5,000 wouldn't do. And the experiment station out here was going to give him the land to put the animals on.
What year was this?
This was, I think, in 59.
Just
recently, and 58 or 59, and then Teal went back east to the University of Vermont at Burlingame and resigned his position. He was a geographer there, a professor of geography, and got another man to take his place, and they couldn't get the grant. So he had to go in there. The last time I saw him, he was in the airplane business.
to make a living.
Huh? He was here a couple of months ago.
Was he here again?
No.
I didn't see him when he was here. I must have been, wasn't here in town.
Well, he's not the same man then that blew up in the northern Canada.
That's the same man.
Some calves, and that's where he got his start.
That's where he got his start, yeah. And he had a film here, maybe you saw it.
It's called Arctic Roundup.
Arctic Roundup, yeah.
And you have about 20 minutes more of tape. Do you have anything on the yaks that we had the problem here with?
Yes, I can tell you second hand about the yaks. I didn't have anything to do with them.
Well, they were just through chasing them out of the tunnels when I was working on the railroad that time, so I heard a lot about them second hand too.
Well, the yaks experiment started about 1917. Isn't that right? Do you remember about that, Edby? Huh? Well, they started the experiment in 17, I think.
No, in Canada.
In Canada.
No, there was about 1929 or 30 they brought them to Fairbanks.
Can we bring?
No, they were here when I came to Fairbanks in 24.
Come up so we can get you on the seat.
Professor Ivor Scarlin, come up here and sit by him. There. Questions and answers will record.
Yeah.
Please.
Fred Johnson, before I came to town, had charge of them out there.
Yeah. They brought in a few from Canada here, and they were already crossed with cattle.
Oh.
And they tried to cross them with Galloway cattle here.
Yeah.
They call them Galloway Yak.
Yes, that's right.
And the story was they got sterile, you know, but they probably weren't, but they didn't breed before they were 3 years old, and they didn't understand that.
Well, they put them where I came into this thing, and they took them, and I think it was 29, wasn't it? They took them down to...
To Healy. Yeah.
Well, when Bunnell took over the agricultural experimental farm, he didn't believe in these experiments. Everybody was handing him out a calf moose to raise, and they were always dying on his hands, so he was disgusted with raising animals. So he was going to kill them. So I went to the Board of Regents and asked the Board of Regents, I said, now they've been 17 years or something like that breeding these animals and getting across the Galliacs, and if you're going to just kill them off, why not give them to somebody to do something? I'll take them. So they gave me the whole bunch. I went down to Healy, and the guy that had charge of them said, now if you can go to Fairbanks and raise $500, we'll kill off these purebred yaks. They're no good for anything, and they got a back like a horse. He said they're not good meat animals, and we'll get in a white-faced bull, and these Galliacs were beautiful animals, you know. They just had a head like a deer on them, you know, and really, but a yak has a head like a horse, you know. He's a knot-headed looking thing and got a narrow back. He's a riding animal, really. So I said, I'll try and see what I do. He said, you'll get a white-faced bull, and in 4 years we'll have a $10,000 investment, or you can just raise $500 to keep me going all winter here. So I thought, well, gee whiz, he can't live on $500 all winter with 4 kids and wife. So I came back to Fairbanks, and I started out to try to raise some money. And there was some woman from Healy that was, these yaks had got in her garden down there, and she just came up to Fairbanks. She talked to all the women around Fairbanks and told them how terrible animals they were. Boy, the stinking, doggone things. They'd eat up all her gardens and broke down the fences, and they weren't any good for anything. You think they're going to raise 5 cents in this ton? I should say not. Nobody wanted to have anything to do with the yaks. So I had to go to the Board of Regents and say, I can't do anything with them. So they brought them up here, and Bunnell slaughtered all the Galliacs, the crosses with the Galloways, which were these animals that were really the start of a fine herd. And Palmer took the pure-blooded ones and sent them out here on Hundred Mile Creek, which is a snow belt.
And one of them wandered over to Rico Wallen's place, and a little bit of a dwarf cow, and it got pneumonia. It was 72 below in Big Delta that year, and it got pneumonia and died on our doorstep. And one of them, a miner out there, and this old bull yak, he chased him up on the roof of his cabin, and came in, and he's telling me about it, and I said, why didn't you take that animal? You're packing stuff over there to your mine on your back. That thing's a fine pack animal if you just train him a little bit. He says, by gosh, I'm going back out there and get that animal and tie him up and feed him and see if I can't break him. And the time he got back there, the poor thing starved to death. These animals were muleys. They were, I guess a yak has been domesticated as long as our cattle. And they didn't know how to keep care of themselves, you know, they just used to, man. I have a lot of pictures of the early days bringing the buffalo in, if you fellas are interested.
Who brought the yak to begin with?
Department of Agriculture brought them in.
Where from? Canada.
They were brought in from Canada, and this bull that they finally brought in, I was out there with him. He was a muley bull too.
And
Canadians got them from Tibet and Mongolia.
But I was in the National, the Rock Creek Park, and then the National Museum or National Zoo there, and they had yaks there that are, gee whiz, they were monstrous animals. You know, about twice the size of this muley, with the horns, you know, like that. Well, they were look like real animals, real range yaks, you know. As they brought them in, they'd have had something to go on.
Why is it hearing those yaks out someplace like Big Delta
or someplace like
that?
They did, and they died.
Yeah. They did, but they put them on 100 Mile Creek, which is a snow belt. And by the time they got in the middle of winter, by the time they got over the decent range, they died.
There were snow belts, weren't they? They were a little place they could put down like that.
It was just a mistake to put them there. They'd been domesticated too many thousands of years anyway. There's the buffalo at Moise, and there's taking him out.
Barnes and Irving, these folks, we have coffee and some cakes ready. Is it all right to bring them out now? And
sure.
You're practically terminating.
I'd like to get these back. I took them out of a.
So you terminate the tape there for me, Irving, before I shut it off?
Okay.
Well, Irving, we enjoyed your talk very much, and
I'm afraid I bored everybody.
We'll proceed now and have a little refreshments. Thank you very much for bringing your pictures and your nice talk on the buffalo and the muskox.
Well, I wanted to get it down it's a part of our history here, and I wanted to get it down so we...
Do you have some history on the reindeer for a later date?
Yeah, I have our old open reindeer too.
Because I used to read about it.
I have all the early records of the reindeer. Well, thanks. There's
the new officers tonight.
I think that's about as far as it goes, Bill. We'll terminate this tape now, and this is October 31st, 1963, and the time is now 9:35 p.m. in the evening at the Chamber of Commerce Log Cabin here in Fairbanks, Alaska.